Thank you. So today I'm going to talk about the Higgs instability during inflation, both how it arises through quantum fluctuations and its space-time dynamics as it starts to backreact on the inflationary space-time, and what we can use this to say about how lucky we are that our early universe survived. So I should say this is work done in collaboration with these folks. Jack Kearney, Bibhushan Shakya, Ho-Jin Yu, and Catherine Zurich, and hopefully it'll appear on the archive in the near future. So first of all, let me give you a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to begin by giving a brief review of the Higgs instability, which is sort of a remarkable prediction of the standard model of particle physics. Then I'm going to talk about how this instability can destabilize the Higgs field during inflation and sort of have important consequences then. I'm going to spend some time focusing in particular on what happens when these unstable Higgs fluctuations start to backreact on the space-time and how they can locally terminate inflation in the regions they develop. And in the process of studying the sort of general relativistic dynamics of these fluctuations, it raises some very interesting questions just from a fundamental gravity point of view related to cosmic censorship, the Hoop conjecture, and black hole topology, and so forth. And then with this understanding of how these regions of true Higgs vacuum develop, I'm going to talk about how that can be folded into a detailed stochastic accounting of how these Higgs fluctuations would arise during inflation. We can actually use that to set bounds on the energy scale that inflation could have happened in the absence of beyond standard model physics. And this project is, I found it to be particularly interesting because it brings together ideas not only in cosmology and particle physics, but also in strong field gravity. So it touches on a lot of the topics that people have been discussing at this conference. So first of all, back before everyone was very excited about the discovery of gravitational waves, a few years ago, the big announcement in physics was the discovery of the Higgs boson at the LHC. And not only did the LHC discover the Higgs boson, but by measuring its mass, it actually figured out that for the sort of central values of the standard model, we fed in a very peculiar part of parameter space, where the electroweak vacuum that we all know and love is actually only metastable. And that's because if you look at the quartic coupling of the Higgs, the coupling that goes like Higgs to the fourth, and you extrapolate that to high energies, you can actually see that at something like 10 to the 10 GeV, this quartic coupling actually turns over and becomes negative. And so what this would say is that if we believe the standard model at these high energies, the Higgs potential actually becomes negative and has these this true vacuum at very large energies. So the fact that we currently observe our universe to be in this electroweak vacuum is not actually inconsistent with it being metastable. And that's just because the probability to vacuum decay to this true vacuum from our current electroweak vacuum is actually exponentially suppressed. And so the lifetime of this metastable vacuum is actually much longer than the age of the universe. However, the story could have been different during inflation. That's basically because De Sitter space has quantum fluctuations, which you can think of as sort of being thermal and corresponding to a temperature given by the Hubble scale during inflation divided by 2 pi. And so as I point out, for example, in Espinoza et al. In 2007, quantum fluctuations from the inflationary background can actually sort of perturb the Higgs vacuum in some region out of its metastable electroweak vacuum and destabilize the Higgs and move it to the unstable part of the potential. And so how likely this is to happen, or equivalently, how many E-folds it would take for you to expect this to develop in some region actually depends on how high the energy scale of inflation is. So if it's high in comparison to the energy scale at which the Higgs potential becomes unstable, which I'll call lambda max, then it would be easier to destabilize the Higgs. And so sort of one of the goals of this work is going to actually put constraints on the Hubble scale of inflation in the absence of beyond standard model physics. And so conversely, if you, in one of those future CMB experiments, we're actually able to measure R and therefore get the energy scale of inflation, then that would actually imply that there must be some new physics beyond the standard model to stabilize the Higgs. So I mean, you can definitely introduce models, and particularly you could couple the Higgs to the inflaton and stabilize it that way or something like that. So I'll actually very briefly mention an example of that. But yeah, I mean, it's true that you know once you start messing with the standard model and as you need to do to add inflaton or something like that, then that'll change things. Though it's not obvious, at least to me, whether or not inflaton would generically stabilize the Higgs or make it even less stable.
This is the point. Inflation usually requires a very weak coupling.
Right.
So that, if you couple it strongly enough, the Higgs can stabilize it. If you worry why it's even more fine tuning required for the inflation.
Right.
So you get it.
So addressing this problem actually has two different parts. So first of all, we need to understand the stochastic development of these unstable Higgs inflations, in this inflationary space-time background. So that's sort of the quantum problem. And then once these Higgs fluctuations are sort of, you have one unlikely one that's particularly large, that it becomes dominated by classical evolution, then it sort of becomes a problem in classical GR to understand the space-time dynamics as this Higgs fluctuation falls the true vacuum and starts to backreact on the space-time. And so this problem has been studied by a number of people. It's attracted a lot of interest, including these people I've listed here and other ones. But the work I'm going to discuss here sort of goes beyond some of the approximations made in these previous studies in a couple of aspects. Primarily, I'm going to talk about using full dynamical GR solutions to understand the development of these true vacuum regions, but also talk about some improvements to understanding the stochastic evolution to get a more accurate bound on the inflationary scale and so forth. So first of all, just want to talk briefly about the stochastic evolution of the Higgs. You can basically think of the probability distribution for the Higgs field and different sort of Hubble size patches as obeying a probability distribution that's governed by a Fokker-Planck equation. And so basically, this encapsulates two different terms. So the first term here on the left has classical effects from basically slow roll motion. That's the drift given by the potential. And then this term on the right-hand side basically is a diffusion-like term coming from the de Sitter-like fluctuations that will sort of randomly perturb the Higgs field. And so this equation sort of combines the classical and quantum effects. And you can sort of think of these de Sitter-like fluctuations. This diffusion term is basically coming from the quantum to classical transition as you have modes exiting the horizon, and they either sort of stochastically add or subtract from the average value of the Higgs field in that patch. And for small fluctuations, initially this diffusion term will dominate. However, once you have a patch that goes sufficiently large Higgs field values, then this classical motion term will begin to dominate, and the Higgs field will sort of run away. So in order to, before we go into the details of that stochastic evolution, it's important to understand, what exactly happens when you have one of these unstable Higgs fluctuations as it falls to the true vacuum. In particular, what effect does it have on the surrounding inflationary space-time? So there's actually been a number of suggestions in the literature about what could happen, ranging from, on the one hand, having sort of a benign crunch. That's where you have these you're developing these crunching regions with the acts of like ADS and that, you know, maybe they'd shrink to sort of negligible volume and not affect the surrounding inflationary space-time as long as they weren't happening everywhere. And then sort of on the other hand, you have this idea that it would basically, having one of these patches could spell disaster, that it would basically move out at the speed of light, you know, eating up all the electroweak vacuum. And so the important question to understanding what bounds we can place on the inflationary scale is you know, sort of what contribution would these two vacuum regions make to the volume? And so this is sort of a question we can answer just using general relativity. Basically, because I argued before, the sort of the Fokker-Planck treatment tells us that these fluctuations basically become classical before they start back reacting on the space-time. Right, sure. Sure. Yeah, basically. You know, are they shrinking to negligible volume? Or are they also expanding like everything else? Sure. So I mean, basically, return to this point a little later, but basically, we want to understand, you know, do these just shrink away and not having an effect on the volume? Are they sort of, you know, expanding like everything else during inflation? Sure. So like our past light cone is basically the volume that we're going to consider.
If it percolates, there's no issue. And I think he's probably really interested in whether or not that's.
Yeah, so some initial work addressing this problem was done in this work by Espinoza et al. In 2015. So basically, what they looked at is using these analytic thin wall approximation solutions, where you basically have a bubble of a spherical bubble of anti-de Sitter space embedded in de Sitter, and basically showed that for reasonable sort of bubble sizes, they would tend to expand, and so that once inflation ends, they could sort of expand at basically the speed of light, engulfing the electroweak vacuum. However, in this work, I'm going to sort of study this actual formation of this true vacuum region, you know, not as you know, you're tunneling to this pure bubble of ADS, but sort of as a dynamical process in GR. And I'm going to argue that gives us some better understanding and some qualitatively new features in understanding how these regions develop. In particular, you know, when we have negative energy density, you know, as we have with this metastable Higgs field, you can actually break what you think of as the usual rules of GR, you know, the requirements on black hole topology, on cosmic censorship, and the Hoop conjecture, and so forth. So I'll return to that a little later in my talk. So in order to understand the classical evolution, what I'm doing is solving the Einstein field equations using these full numerical solutions, and then coupling this to just a classical scalar field, the Higgs field. And the potential I'm using here just has a constant part that represents the contribution from inflation, and then it has a negative quartic coupling, as is appropriate for these high energies where these fluctuations go unstable. And then I'm adding one extra beyond standard model term that basically just you know, at values of the Higgs field near the Planck scale actually prevents you from rolling off to negative infinity. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about how, you know, exactly how you add this extra term is not that important in sort of determining the qualitative results, but it's also somewhat of a numerical convenience because you don't want to be able to go to arbitrarily large negative energies. So we're considering here, starting with a space-time that's very nearly de Sitter, and then we have this small Higgs fluctuation that's unstable, and has some initial amplitude and some initial characteristic size R. So the first thing you can sort of notice is that just because you have unstable Higgs fluctuation, it's not going to necessarily fall immediately to the true vacuum. First of all, if its amplitude is sort of below this value that I have at the top here, H of SR, for it to exit slow roll, then Hubble friction will be important, and it can take many Hubble times to actually fall to the true vacuum. In addition, when you consider Higgs fluctuations with some finite extent, they're also going to want to spread to basically due to gradient terms. and the equations of motion. And so, you know, basically, you get a similar constraint on when this gradient spreading will be more important than falling to the true vacuum to the potential. And basically, these two turns will be comparable when you have Hubble radius size fluctuations. And so that's sort of shown in this plot here. So I won't go through all the different curves, but basically here I'm showing the maximum value of the Higgs field as a function of time for various different initial amplitudes and initial characteristic sizes. So the black curves are these small initial fluctuations that are about a tenth of the Hubble radius. And you can see that for some cases, even though the amplitudes are above this regime to exit slow roll, they still initially decrease due to this gradient spreading. And conversely, if you have very large fluctuations, even if they're below this amplitude to exit the slow roll regime, they'll still take several or more Hubble times to actually fall to the true vacuum. So in this case, I've just sort of fixed those values for this particular case such that the minimum of the potential is like 100 times the inflationary energy scale, and that the cutoff is at 1/10 of Planck mass. That's where the minimum is. But it's not that sensitive to that, because this is basically governed by, you know, what's going on at the low energies. Yeah, but but in particular, the sort of the stochastic calculation is telling us that we're creating these fluctuations that are becoming classical with basically characteristic size that's a Hubble radius or more, and their amplitude is sort of in the regime to exit slow roll. So in this case, these fluctuations will sort of in approximately a Hubble time fall to the true vacuum. They're just increasingly large initial amplitudes. Yeah.
So the prediction of the quantum tunnels picture is that the Higgs field jumps a very large amount.
Right. So that's sort of like the Coleman-DeLucia type idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I think for the regime I'm interested here, it's more like the Hawking-Moss inciton type thing, or like the Fokker-Planck, where you're just having, you know, lots and lots of quantum fluctuations that eventually push you over.
So where is the
So for this value, the true minimum is at 1/10 of the Planck value. There's no maximum here. So, yeah. So this is all a classical calculations. So right now I'm just talking about the classical picture of these already unstable Higgs fluctuations. So I can show you here the evolution of the Higgs field. This is for a case where you have basically a Hubble size fluctuation, and then it's half a Hubble radius in the other direction. And you can see as we evolve, you start with an initially pretty small Higgs fluctuation normalized to its value at the true minimum, and then it grows, and then eventually gets some oscillations as it reaches its true minimum, and then you actually find an apparent horizon around this region. And this apparent horizon grows, and you can see this ring where the Higgs value is sitting very near its minimum value also grows. And I should say that these coordinates sort of morally correspond to co-moving coordinates. So on top of all of this, there's also exponential expansion happening. And I can also show you the energy density for the same case. So initially, it's boring, nothing's happening. It's just dominated by the inflationary energy scale. But then you'll see as the Higgs fluctuation actually falls towards true minimum, it'll become negative, and then it'll go to very high energy density in the center, and that creates the black hole. And then you have this black hole where its mass is basically compensated by this ring of negative energy density, so such that a faraway observer wouldn't really see any mass, and they're both sort of expanding. So I'm just finding, you know, marginally outer trapped surfaces, basically, the apparent horizons. And finally, I can look at the expansion. So initially, the whole universe is just undergoing exponential expansion. And then once the Higgs fluctuation reaches its true vacuum, you see that expansion goes into contraction. You get this crunching region. So it gets this expanded region that's crunching. But in this case, it seems like, you know, we can't see this crunching singularity or anything because it's hidden behind this horizon.
Is this a three-dimensional
symmetric?
It's axisymmetric.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just assuming rotational symmetry.
Any reason?
Some of these cases are spherically symmetric. But I also later in the talk I'll start to talk about some interesting effects when you consider very non-spherical fluctuations. But yeah, but everything I've said so far applies to the spherical case. Yeah, so you know, one thing we can learn from this picture is that, you know, basically crunching isn't benign. You know, in this picture, you have the Higgs field falling to its true vacuum, and it's liberating large amounts of potential energy. And so that energy goes into the gradient and kinetic energy of the field, and it's in this crunching region. It's the perfect recipe to create a black hole. And then as this black hole expands, you know, surrounded by this region of negative energy density, there's no way to, you know, get that energy back out to cancel out this region of negative energy density. And so, you know, basically there's no way to get rid of this crunching region, at least classically.
Actually, that's not true. If you collide two of them, you can do that.
Okay.
I'll show you how later.
But would you generically expect to have two of these, you know, rare fluctuations in causal contact?
I should hope so. Otherwise, you're going to have to worry about Neil's question regarding the method problem and whether or not you actually worry about this.
Okay.
If they're really rare, then it's not a problem. In some measure.
Right. Yeah, so we can also look at the evolution of these Higgs fluctuations. Just look at the sort of characteristic, both the radius of the initial Higgs fluctuation, which are these solid curves on top, and the radius of this region of true vacuum as it forms. So in this plot on the left, I'm showing you for a spherically symmetric case with a compactly supported fluctuation, these two different cases. And so basically, what you can see is that, you know, even before the region of true vacuum forms, these initial fluctuations are expanding outwards. And then at some later time, you form these regions of true vacuum. So as I mentioned here, the black case is in De Sitter, and the initial fluctuation has a Hubble radius size. And then the blue curve actually corresponds to Minkowski space, or the limiting case where the size of the fluctuation is very small compared to Hubble. And so sort of the more interesting thing is if you look at the right-hand panel and look at basically the characteristic of these space-time curves. So look at the proper distance squared per coordinate time squared. So what you can see is that these initial fluctuations at the bottom here are time-like. They're basically, you know, start off moving slowly, and then as time goes on, are moving closer and closer to the speed of light. However, the radius of the true vacuum, that space-time curve, actually traces out a space-like curve. And so basically, this is telling you that you shouldn't really think of this bubble is expanding out causally. What's actually happening is you have this Higgs fluctuation, it's moving outwards, and then as, you know, for a certain point, this fluctuation hits it, then it's gonna fall to the true vacuum very quickly and basically causally disconnected from what its neighboring points are doing. And, you know, in particular, in the case where you have, you know, your have inflation and you're exponentially expanding, then this Higgs fluctuation is getting more and more causally disconnected from itself as inflation sort of wins out. And so as you can imagine, the exact details of what are going on at the very high energies in the potential don't really matter. So this just illustrates that point for these Gaussian size fluctuations of the Hubble radius for various values of this potential varying the value of the potential at its true minimum and the Higgs value where that takes it on. And you can see it doesn't make that much difference on exactly how these things evolve. So now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about what happens when you consider very non-spherical fluctuations. So to begin with, because we're sort of forming these fluctuations by stochastically adding up lots of different modes, we have no reason to expect them to be spherical in general. And also, while normally we expect that black holes are sort of roughly spherical, we know that topologically, apparent horizons, given some energy conditions and so forth, should be topologically spherical. And we also think that roughly black hole horizons should be geometrically spherical. This is encapsulated in Kip Thorne's hoop conjecture, which I'll mention, but basically says that black hole horizons can't be arbitrarily elongated, and one length can't be much longer than the other lengths. But these sort of usual rules don't actually apply to, for example, anti-de Sitter space. So for example, in anti-de Sitter space, you can write down black string solutions or black cylinders. These are solutions written down by Lemos. And so these violate these black topology requirements. And so one interesting question is, here we're not actually in asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. We're starting from de Sitter, but we do have this negative energy density, so what's going to happen? And it's sort of a toss-up here. So what I'm going to do is consider a set of sort of ellipsoidal Gaussian fluctuations where one radius, the radius along the symmetry axis, is longer and longer compared to the radius in the equatorial plane. And so on the one hand, you might say, if we have this Higgs fluctuation and it's falling to the true vacuum and it's forming this crunching region, then cosmic censorship says that we shouldn't be able to see that from outside observers, so we should hide this crunching behind a horizon. On the other hand, Kip Thorne has this hoop conjecture, which basically says that we should form a black hole horizon if and only if we have some mass that's contained within a region such that if you took a hoop of circumference 4 pi m, this hoop would be able to pass over the mass in every direction. So in particular, it can't be arbitrarily long in some direction such that the hoop doesn't fit. And so Kip Thorne used this to argue that why, for example, for cylindrical collapse, you don't actually get a black hole horizon under normal circumstances. You get a naked singularity. So the question is, which one of these ideas is going to win for this case? So here I'm considering a series of more and more elongated horizons with aspect ratios all the way up to 8. And actually, in all cases, you do find that a horizon forms. And so here I'm showing you the polar circumference of the horizon normalized by 4 pi times m, where m is just the mass measured from the area of the apparent horizon. So you can see you get larger and larger violations of the hoop conjecture. And for these ones I've done, up to a factor of 2. But furthermore, you can actually look at the equatorial radius of the horizon, basically the skinny waist for these different cases. And basically, in all the different cases, the evolution looks very similar. So it's not really that sensitive to what's going on in the long part of the black hole. And furthermore, you can actually go to the infinite aspect ratio case just by imposing a translational symmetry in the z direction. And so in that case, you still form a horizon. And so in this case, it's actually you're dynamically forming essentially a black string. And so this sort of suggests that you should be able to form these arbitrarily elongated horizons in this case as well. Yeah, so now I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about how we can use this fact that basically these regions of true vacuum can persist, exponentially expand through inflation, and then once inflation stops, basically expand at the speed of light to eat up the electroweak vacuum. We're going to use this idea to try to place bounds on the energy scale of inflation. And so basically, we're just going to use a very simple criterion that basically we don't want to develop any of these regions of true vacuum in our past light cone. Basically the observational fact we're using here is just that our universe is still around and wasn't engulfed in this giant crunching region. So for the work I'm going to talk about here, are actually going to incorporate some new features that weren't previously done in these stochastic calculations, including the full running of the coupling of the Higgs potential, and numerically resolving the Fokker-Planck equation down to very small probabilities, e to the minus 180, that would correspond to having a single patch, of a single inflating patch, in 60 E folds. And we're doing this with the help of some sort of numerical tricks to solve the full Fokker-Planck equation. So the strategy here, we're solving the Fokker-Planck equation with this potential, just Higgs to the fourth power, with this running coupling. And so here, the coupling is evaluated at basically the root mean squared of the Higgs value and the Hubble evolutionary scale. And so at small values, this quartic coupling will be positive and it'll suppress fluctuations. And then for these rare fluctuations that go to large Higgs values, those will actually be enhanced because they'll be in the unstable part of the potential. And I'm going to argue that these sort of non-Gaussian effects are important. And basically what we want to do is find this number n max, which is basically the number of E folds that you need for particular Higgs potential parameters in order to develop basically one Hubble-sized region where the Higgs value has exited the slow roll regime, or where the probability of finding that is basically e to the minus 3n. So you expect one patch in your past light cone. And basically once the Higgs value reaches this H of SR, then it's going to fall rapidly to the true vacuum in a Hubble time or less. So there's no way to stabilize it during preheating or something like that. So I'm going to show you the sort of evolution of the probability distribution. On the y-axis here, I'm showing you the log of the probability for the Higgs value to take on a certain value. So we're going to very small probabilities. And then on the x-axis, I'm showing you the Higgs field value normalized by the Hubble scale. And so the black curve is the full Fokker-Planck solution, and the blue and the green curves just show various Gaussian approximations assuming different values of different constant values of the quartic coupling. And then I'm also showing this black dot here, which basically shows you as a function of E, of the number of E folds, what the maximum Higgs value you expect to have one patch and or greater. So you can see as we go through more and more E folds of inflation, this probability increases. But you can also see that the full Fokker-Planck solution is suppressed at small Higgs fields relative to the Gaussian approximation, but it also develops this long non-Gaussian tail because of the running of the coupling. And in fact, this long non-Gaussian tail is sort of essential in allowing this quick transition sort of at the end to this value where the Higgs field exits slow roll. And for these particular parameters I've chosen, it takes 60 E folds to develop one patch, which you expect to fall to the true vacuum. Yeah, so this curve here basically just shows the constraints you can put on the inflationary energy scale in relation to this lambda max, the value which the Higgs potential goes unstable for a various number of E folds. So the black curve is the full Fokker-Planck solution, and I won't go into what the other various curves are, but there are various other results using different approximations. And so you can see that this is not giving you like an order of magnitude difference, but the shape of these curves are different when you incorporate these new effects. And so for 60, this canonical 60 E fold value, we get that the inflationary Hubble scale has to be less than 0.07 times lambda max. That's the energy scale at which the Higgs potential is at its maximum. So above that, it's unstable. So I'll, and then the next plot, we can talk about the value of that in GeV. So basically for the canonical values of the standard model, this 0.07 lambda max would correspond to 3.5 times 10 to the 9 GeV. However, there's a large orders of magnitude uncertainty on this value just due to experimental uncertainty. So I can show you that here. So basically, in this plot, on the x-axis, I'm showing you the mass of the Higgs boson in GeV. And on the y-axis, we're showing the mass of the top quark in GeV. And so these ellipses are the basically the different standard deviation values for the experimental error in these quantities. And then these straight black lines are basically the limits for various values of these two masses that you can put on the Hubble inflationary scale in GeV. So the blue part of the curve is where the Higgs potential would actually be stable. And this thin green region is the region that's ruled out by the current Planck observations. And so this whole red region here is saying, what if we had a CMB experiment that could measure R somewhere above 0.002? And so if we did that, then we could basically rule out this whole red region, where if we made that measurement, then we need some beyond standard model physics. So those would be values where the Higgs potential actually wouldn't reach a lower minimum than the electroweak vacuum before you reach the Planck scale.
So there is no constraint.
Right. Yeah, and so just to emphasize, this whole story will change, if you add some beyond standard model physics. So this is just one example of sort of a simple thing that you could do, which is to couple the Higgs potential to the inflaton, or just some other term that basically gives you an extra term of the potential that's like Hubble squared times h squared. And so this just shows you that for various values of this coupling constant, if it's positive, then you can relax these constraints on the Hubble scale and during inflation. And around values of 0.4 or something, then you can basically have arbitrarily high values of this. Yeah, so that. Yeah. Right. So I'm ignoring all these issues of what exactly the inflaton potential is and what it's doing. But yeah. So basically, I'm just adding this term to the potential and redoing these Fokker-Planck equations. Yeah. So that basically brings me to my conclusion. So, one thing I talked about is how, in the absence of beyond standard model physics, we can actually use this Higgs instability to place, interesting bounds on the energy scale of inflation that might be tested by future CMB experiments, for example. And also, though these patches of true vacuum are actually fatal for the surrounding regions of the universe, are actually very interesting from a fundamental gravity point of view. And you know, I found this especially interesting because it's sort of, you know, a quote-unquote realistic setting to study these ADS-like features. You know, we heard a number of talks yesterday about all the interesting things that happen in ADS, and those are mainly motivated by the gravity gauge duality. But here, you know, we're also getting similar things like, you know, the ability to determine inflation, develop these black strings, and so forth, and they're arising in our like an asymptotically de Sitter universe. And so I also think there's some interesting questions here to sort of figure out, you know, what, how many of these things I talked about are very particular to having negative energy density, and if that is the case, you know, why that has these all these special properties that don't hold when you have when you restrict yourself to positive energy. So should definitely want to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk, and also, you know, thank the universe for surviving.
What if there are new particles, scalar particles above the Higgs? What if the putative new 750 GeV scalar resonance is confirmed? We will know soon. How will this affect your calculations?
Yeah, so I'm definitely not an expert in that question. I mean, I guess, you know, definitely if you have new particles, you need to go redo the calculation of what exactly the quark decoupling does. Though it's not obvious to me, you know, how that will change the story one way or the other, whether it would make it more unstable or less unstable.
But I would expect it to significantly affect it.
I mean, yeah, it's not obvious to me that it would generically get rid of it, but I'm definitely not an expert in that question. And I think there are many different models for what that 750 GeV bump could be.
Yeah, so first point is that this makes the initial conditions problem a little bit more strange for inflation, because in all your calculations, you had to assume the Higgs field started in the...
Yeah, exactly.
Did not start in the true vacuum, as well as the inflatons not starting in its true vacuum.
Right.
So now you've got double problem of initial conditions. But I was interested to ask, how do you think the two parts of your talk connected? Because the first part was about the classical evolution and included all the geometry of the black holes. The second part, just the Fokker-Planck equation. So can you tell what geometry of black holes the Fokker-Planck evolution is going to lead to? Do you have any intuition?
No, I mean, that's sort of the limitation of this approach, is that you sort of basically gotten rid of the spatial information by sort of summing over these Hubble size patches.
Right. Is there any way to sort of at least heuristically go from the Fokker-Planck result to the geometry in space-time? Or do you think it's just impossible?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is the Fokker-Planck equation is saying that, you know, it's not exactly telling you what the spatial shape of these Higgs fluctuations are going to be, but, you know, sort of before they start back reacting the space-time, then you should be able to treat them classically.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you'd probably need a more sophisticated approach to have more information about that.
Mm-hmm. There's no way of putting spatial gradients into the Fokker-Planck equation in some very simplified way? So then you could, you know, measure correlators, spatial correlators in the Fokker-Planck description, and that might tell you something about the geometry of the field as it was rolling towards a true vacuum.
Yeah, I mean, I think there might be some more sophisticated treatment to that, but I haven't looked into that in detail. But that would be interesting, yeah.
One naive thing you might imagine doing is you've just got a random field, so you could use peak theory of Gaussian random fields and figure out what the average ellipticity of these blobs are, and then that's one answer.
Yeah, but sort of what this was saying, though, is that it's the non-Gaussian tail that's really giving you all this.
I think that,
interesting
that, stuff. That, yeah, that's true. That'd be interesting to think about.
More questions? Okay, if not, so we're gonna go to a coffee break now, and we'll be back at 10:50.